Variety is the spice of life. A company relies on the variety of its employees to allow it to be agile and meet its business needs. When you can find a single individual that embodies variety within himself, that's extremely special and should be looked for. In this episode, I think we found that person. Hello, I'm Robert Hess. I'd like you to join me as we look at the technology and the person behind the code. In this episode, we have Mohsen Eggson. Mohsen's career at Microsoft started in the early 1990s, and he's had a variety of different jobs at the company during that time, from land manager, Complus, Core, Exchange Server, Visual Studio, Jade, and many others. Mohsen's career has expanded through a lot of different areas of Microsoft and watching it evolve and grow a long time. So please join me in welcoming Mohsen Eggson. Now, Mohsen, when I brought you on, I iterated through just a few of the different jobs you've had here at Microsoft. You've had quite a variety of jobs. What prompted you to move around so much?
Short attention span, or no? When you have a passion for software and you're in a company like Microsoft, there's so much opportunity. It's actually hard to resist, to be honest. And having showed up kind of again as the company was really growing and expanding and seeing opportunities arise, I decided to take advantage of many of them. And obviously, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of my career was on the enterprise computing front, where we just kept upping the ante and investing more and more. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you're so involved in technology here at Microsoft, deeply in so many different areas, I'm assuming your interest in technology got an early start.
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember the exact starting date and time of when I developed a passion for technology, but I think in my early childhood, my parents commented that I used to build fake computers out of shoe boxes and put plastic screws in them and make them pretend that they were keyboards and what have you.
You're almost making me feel old, because in my childhood they would have been car boxes, not shoe boxes.
Yeah, that's probably true even back then. I did use a card punch machine in college, so that tells you how old I am. Yeah.
Now, did you do any computing in high school and college and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, the first device I still remember was, I was late high school, was a programmable calculator by Casio, and it had a basic interpreter, and I decided to try and write a version of Space Invaders on the thing, and failed miserably on that, but I tried.
Now, some of your early career choices, how did they get you prepared for getting into technology?
Well, I mean, again, I've pretty much my entire career has been in technology. When I first started at Microsoft, I think I made a career choice, partly driven by my own desire, partly by my family, to do consulting. And I was kind of a classic software guy, so for me, the idea of consulting wasn't what I thought I really wanted to do. And yet, in retrospect, turned out to be an amazing experience, because it gave me a chance to be in these large accounts and to see companies like IBM and the presence they have and the infrastructure and technology that they have. And so in a way, that kind of motivated me to come back to Redmond and see if we can also become a serious enterprise player.
Now, so what are some of the jobs you've had after the consulting stuff there?
Okay, let me see if I can remember. I spent a year in development tools. And that was, once I spent time in consulting, I realized I really wanted to do things. I wanted to go back to Redmond. I wanted to build product. And I really wanted to be part of an enterprise play. I felt that even though we weren't really kind of a great enterprise player at the time, that we definitely had an opportunity. And I started understanding how much money there really is and how much opportunity there really is in that market. So my first year was I came back and I focused on enterprise development tools. Strangely enough, now I don't even know how many years later, that's back what I'm doing again.
And by development tools, you mean the compiler and linker? And
it was more, at the time, we were actually looking at case tools and repositories and trying to figure out what should we do about high-end development tools for the enterprise, and working with partners like Texas Instruments on their IEF product and what have you. And some of the folks joined us back, a lot of the people we recruited were, from that era. And then I decided to, the company decided we're going to start investing in transaction processing in general on databases and up the ante on that. So I did a small piece of technology that is still shifted to the state called the Distributed Transaction Coordinator. Had an opportunity to hire a lot of industry hires and senior people, and shipped that in SQL Server. And then after that, what did I do? Then we started this small project called Viper, which became the Microsoft Transaction Server. Shipped that. Calm, Complus, B-Central.
No, B-Central, again, there's a kind of a shift then.
Yep.
Because B-Central is totally different than what you'd worked on before, except for the consulting side. It kind of touched upon that a bit.
Yeah, I had spent at that point, I guess I would have probably spent about 10 years on the enterprise side of the house, and I'd seen products again like our file server products, our database products, email products, all these things mature and become real credible enterprise players. So I decided to... I caught the internet bug, and again, Microsoft is a place of great opportunity, and looking at the internet at the time, we had realized that there would be a nice opportunity for us in the small to medium business market, and jumped on the B-Central bandwagon and got a chance to work with some awesome people on that as well, and did that for a few years, and then I caught the consumer bug and did games for a little bit.
Games. Yeah. Tell me about that. Because this is another shift in what you were doing.
Again, that's I don't know if it's me or Microsoft or both. I think it's, maybe I'm kind of just a reflection of the company I'm in a way. Again, if you have a passion for technology and software, I don't think you can pigeonhole it into, well, I just like databases. Mm-hmm. That's all I care about. I'm a gamer. I've always been a gamer. And I think it was David Vaskovich who used to remind me that everybody thinks they're going to be good at, UI design and interior design. And I think there's kind of a similar rule for gamers. Every gamer looks at games and says, oh, I can build a better one. And again, being in a great environment and having the opportunity to do it, of course, I jumped on that. And we built a small game that we really never finished called Cargo. And but that was an amazing experience.
I think we actually have a clip of Cargo we can take a look at here and just kind of see what the results were of your efforts.
Sure. The whole idea was this was a game about... car combat with kind of role-playing elements, and it kind of had a sci-fi story behind it. But the whole basic idea was we all, maybe, I don't know if it's boys or girls or both, but we like to play with toy cars as kids. What if you had toy cars and story and opportunity to customize these kind of cars and participate in kind of a grand story? And that's what Cargo was. It brought elements of car combat and role-playing, which at the time actually hadn't, I don't think anybody had done those. And since then, there's been a few car combat role-playing games out.
So you kind of really, on the forefront of that whole technology thing then.
Yeah, I hope we get some badly due credit on that.
But I mean, it looks like a fun game. I didn't.
It was a fun game. Yeah. Every now and then, I still, we use some of the old drops and we play around with it, and it was kind of it was an amazing experience. It was a great learning experience for me. You get to understand that, just like software, shipping games is not just about how good the idea is or how good the gameplay or the quality of the game or the visuals. There's a complicated machine that you have to be part of, and you have to fit into that machine to be able to succeed in that business. And in our particular case, we didn't invest as much in producers and the production staff as we probably should have, and managing the relationship between us as a development house and the publisher, in-house.
And by that you mean exactly what does that entail?
Basically, again, I think imagine trying to build a movie in Hollywood without a producer. You can't really describe the role of a producer, and yet they are so critical. And I think we had kind of underestimated the importance of that. You say, you tell yourself, look, I've got a great idea, I have great visuals, I have a great crew. Of course it's going to sell. Of course it's going to get published. And then you get killed by a death of a thousand cuts. So we did not invest early and enough in having producers be on board, coordinating our relationship with the publisher, making sure that everything that we're doing fits into their portfolio, fits into their plans, et cetera.
Your attempt to go into the game market, what'd you fall back on after that?
Then I went back to enterprise, and I went back to my roots, and I joined the Exchange Server Organization as I guess the person running that organization, and that was an amazing experience. That was my transition. That's a job where I had to do a vice president job, a great deal of business and process responsibility, partners, customers, getting yelled at on the phone by customers and what have you. And just again, what an amazing place to be in, to have an opportunity to do something like that as well. And Exchange was a phenomenal product, and I was proud to be part of the Exchange Server 2003 release, codenamed Titanium, and did that for a little while and learned a tremendous amount. And then it was time to rest for a little bit.
And by rest, you mean what?
Well, I decided at the time that it was a combination of things. I really wanted to move to Hawaii. And so I decided to kind of move my family to Hawaii. The company was very gracious and offered to try and find me a role where I can still contribute while being in Hawaii. But at the time, I really wasn't sure. First, I really wanted to move and settle my family and go through all these things and make sure that I don't like half working. So either I really, really worked at Microsoft or I didn't work at Microsoft. So I chose to be conservative and say, I'm not going to work, and moved my family to Hawaii. I started my own company mostly because that was an environment I can be comfortable saying, well, I'll just work less or I'll do things whenever I feel like it. I didn't feel good about putting Microsoft in that spot. I did that for about 2.5 years. And when I felt that I really can work and I really do want to work and I want to work hard, then, the old term is I picked up the phone, but I sent an email and kicked off the process. And the company graciously accepted me back into the fold. And I looked around.
So then you moved back to Redmond to work here, right?
No, I didn't move back to Redmond. Once, you know, it's Hawaii is a place that either you love it or hate it. And if you love it, it's a very hard place to move out of. And I definitely love Hawaii. So we'd made the commitment as a family, and I definitely, it's you know, you've been there, so you can probably understand. I looked around for opportunities, kind of almost taking the company up on the original offer, saying, is there an opportunity for me to do remote work and really contribute? I didn't want a staff role. I didn't want kind of a consulting advisory role. I really wanted a role that also had
make
a difference and to have an execution responsibilities. I guess behind the code, I still like the code. I like to write production code. I want to be part of a ship cycle. So as I looked around and talked to a few people, I decided to kind of, again, you know, maybe deja vu all over again, and maybe it's good to take another run at tools. And by now, I think we are in a similar position in enterprise tools as we were in enterprise servers probably in the mid-90s. I see a huge amount of opportunity. We're just starting to enter that business with the Visual Studio Team System products. We have a huge amount of opportunity. We have a huge amount of growth and challenges. So I kind of resonated with that in particular, but the Visual Studio product in general, I'm a VS user. I've been a VS user forever, and maybe like the game thing, it's like I can make this thing better. And so if the next one isn't better, you can partly blame me now.
So essentially, then you're now working on a small development team in Hawaii, working on a Visual Studio component.
That's exactly right. It's we call them feature crews in Visual Studio, and VS is a very unique product and organization in the sense of you have a fairly large organization of, you know, a couple thousand people, but it's internally is fairly agile because it's constructed out of these small, we call them feature crews, and the feature crews almost run on, there are some synchronized schedules or some overlapped schedules. So in Hawaii, we have a very small feature crew, probably the smallest feature crew in Visual Studio, working on a small component that we're going to add on to Visual Studio Team System, hopefully in the next release.
I mean, it sounds like you had a very varied career here at Microsoft, had done an awful lot of different things. Yep. And I think that kind of helped, you know, form who you are and the value you bring to the company. We actually talked with a number of people that you've worked with in the past. One of those people was Pat Helen. He shared with us some of his thoughts about why you are who you are and what exactly it is you bring to the company. Let's take a look at that.
I'd love to learn that because I'm not sure myself.
When people come together, one of the biggest problems in engineering is bridging the gap of different expectations and different understandings. Because Mohsen's breadth of experience, he's able to understand where people are coming from and where teams are coming from. Based upon that understanding, he can bridge the gap and cause a solution that allows us to move forward.
So, bridging the gap, that seemed to be a topic that not only I heard multiple times, but also I noticed in talking with you, the several times we've talked, that you actually do. And so I'd like to actually spend some time talking about how that bridging the gap comes about and what your thoughts are. Now, we've already discussed briefly how the enterprise was something that you kind of saw forming inside of Microsoft, and you played a role in that. Maybe we can kind of talk about, you know, how Microsoft turned from being a personal computer company into a company that's now so focused and so driven and so involved in the enterprise market.
Well, first, I'm proud to have played a role. I don't know if it's really a big role or not, but I'm proud to have played a small role in that. I think we as a company have always had a great deal of wisdom when it comes to, maybe not a right term to use, but picking our battles, you know, where we tend to focus a lot on a particular area. We'll kind of build top-notch products. And again, you can always look back at our history and say, you know what, we did make the right decision. We weren't ready to be an enterprise company in the mid-80s. We just weren't. It wasn't in our DNA. It wasn't something we understood. So I think I'm not the only one who saw the gap. You know, David Vaskovich saw the gap. Paul Moritz saw the gap. A number of people in the company by the late 80s, even before I showed up, had started observing the gap. And it's one of the reasons they started establishing things like, well, let's build a consulting service so that we can at least have people who are Microsoft employees who are on site with these corporations who actually see what they actually build, what they deploy, what they use on a daily basis. So the first thing we did right is we didn't jump in too early, because we would have lost credibility and we would have gotten kicked out, and I don't know that we would have ever recovered out of that. So we took our time. The second thing we've done right, and I think that's something we don't get enough credit for as a company, we're the only company in the world that I know of that seems to have the ability to build products that have that amazing breadth in terms of dealing with consumer as well as enterprise. The same people who use Word to write, you know, letters or Outlook to write emails at home are using in very professional enterprise scenarios. So when we got in at the right time, we got in with a set of principles that, you know, again, a number of people had insisted on in terms of how were we going to differentiate ourselves. And third, and probably most importantly, we decided we're going to go in there, and it's going to be a very long, very complicated process, and we're going to stick with it through thick and thin. And it was definitely bumpy in the beginning, and it just kept getting better.
If you think about the products coming out of Microsoft, we had our first enterprise mail program.
Yep.
Was something we weren't even using internally.
Yep.
Instead, we're using Wizmail still.
Yep.
And other products like that. And it wasn't until actually Outlook, where that was the corporate email program, mm-hmm. that I think we actually understood.
And again,
it's like dog-fooding your own products.
Absolutely, and I'm a huge believer in that. And being on Visual Studio, I get frustrated when I see us not using Visual Studio internally sometimes. I mean, we all use the compilers and debuggers and all that stuff, but do we really use the IDE and push it to its limit as Microsoft developers? And I think it varies. And, you know, I totally agree with the mindset of, if it's not good enough for us, I don't know that it's really good enough for our customers. That being said, we can't be kind of too internally focused. We have to, you know, we build products that scale to millions of, hundreds of millions of users in many cases. So we have to also remember, we can't just build them for Microsoft.
Right.
But I think if it doesn't work internally, that for me is a fairly worrisome sign.
Yeah, because the flip side of that, if it's not a product we need, no one else needs it either, isn't always the case.
That's true. That's true. Especially, you know, we're a company of 70,000 employees and, mm-hmm. you know, distributed around the world.
We've always been technology focused, whether it was a personal computer or the enterprise.
Yeah.
It's very focused on the geeky developer, the people that reflected who Microsoft was.
Absolutely.
And the designer had always been kind of left out in the cold a bit. And now we're starting to pay attention to the designer with Server,
absolutely.
With WPF, and with the Expression Toolset.
For designers, I'm really excited. It's a lot of the strategy isn't fully, I shouldn't say cooked, but a lot of the strategy isn't, you know, kind of fully out there yet. But I think the trend that we're going down, especially with WPF and something like Expression Blend, for example, we're going to give designers new business opportunities and new innovation opportunities that they hadn't really thought much about. A lot of the design tools so far have been about, well, I'll give you a design tool that if you were starting from scratch, here's kind of what's interesting. Not many people have given people design tools to say, no, there's existing apps in the world, and that pretty much the world is dominated by these things, existing websites, existing apps. How can you actually make these things? What kind of a business opportunity can you have? Mm-hmm. Just showing up to an organization and saying, I can make your existing apps look better, layout better, behave better, be more accessible. So that's definitely one of the things that excites me the most about, we're not 100% there yet, but that's kind of where I think one of the great opportunities we have.
We've pretty well, you know, discussed how Microsoft goes after different market segments, the computer user, the enterprise, and a little touch on the design audience. Mm-hmm. Like that. The design audience really fascinates me a bit, because it brings out another aspect of computer programming, and that is regards to how important is user interface design to an application. I suppose, you know, especially in your case, where you're working on a geeky developer tool in Visual Studio, how important is well-thought-out design, or should we just get back to command-line compilers and linkers?
I'm gonna maybe regret saying this, but I actually think UI is everything. You know, it is important to scale, it is important to be secure. I mean, those are kind of breads and butters, but I really think that UI in software is almost, maybe not 100%, but is almost everything. And we use, that's maybe one of the things that we've lost track of over the years. Of we all think it's important. Every now and then we stop thinking that it's the most important thing. Ultimately, it's all about what the user experiences, even if they're a network administrator, even if they're a user of the network, even if they are these high-end database, you know, DBA types. User experience is everything. And historically, a lot of our competitors, for example, in enterprise, didn't have that religion. They would sacrifice usability in a heartbeat for scalability. And if we had done that, I don't think we would have had the success that we've had so far. And it wouldn't be Microsoft SQL Server. It would be Microsoft DB2. It would be, you know, Microsoft something else. And so I think that's an area where we have room, again, to reinvent ourselves a little bit, to look back at what's served us well and what hasn't, and to maybe kind of start thinking harder about pushing, you know, pushing the bar higher and higher on user experience. Mm-hmm. So even for Visual Studio, I mean, I've gone back and forth. I code all the time, so I use Razzle. I sit in the command prompt, but I'm not happy when I'm using a command prompt. Not to take away, I actually like command lines, but there's so much opportunity in the visual experience associated with software. And actually, the particular project I'm working on right now has a lot to do with how you look at software. What does it mean to look at software? And I think it's incredibly important. And it's an area, actually, to be honest, you look at IDEs today, they look exactly the same as they did in maybe the early 90s, maybe even before that, I'm not quite sure. I mean, VS has a couple things. Form designers, since VB1 is probably the first big shift in a developer experience. Maybe,
and it was something that really wasn't necessarily targeted at developers either. It was targeted people that weren't developers.
No, and yeah, the whole idea was it was originally Ruby for the shell, extending the Windows shell, and almost a user mentality. But that's a fantastic example of the user mentality. If you can build something that's easy enough for a user to use and somehow give it the power that a developer would want.
That takes our job away, though, doesn't it?
We'll find new stuff to do. I'm pretty sure. We're good at inventing things. So, but I think that principle, I love the principle of it, especially even for a dev tool. And administration tools are the brothers and sisters of development tools, because you can very quickly convince yourself, well, I've got a really complicated task. It's just going to be complicated. Well, that's not good enough. You know, if you actually thought about spreadsheets and the things people do with spreadsheets. Especially if you think about building them in a very domain-specific way. Yeah, if we never thought about the spreadsheet as this general-purpose, flexible thing, oh, I'll give you a budgeting tool, I'll give you a planning tool, a P&L tool, all these things, they would be unbelievably complicated. And there's more feature richness in that than probably any network or database administration product.
So does that specifically mean, though, simplifying the application? Like to take the Visual Studio VB story, does it mean taking Visual Studio and turning it into something that anybody could use because it is so easy? Or does it mean making the tool that much easier or more intuitive to use by the real geeky developers?
I think it's more the former than the latter. The geeky developers have figured it out. And the geeky developers want Razzle. They want, you know, actually, they probably don't even like the visual debuggers, right? They want SDB. They want, you know, GDB. They want, you know. So the geeky developers have kind of, you can almost argue, they've figured it out. One of the things that we have a challenge is attracting new talent into computer science and into software in general. And I don't think that we can take every one of the old paradigms and use those as attractive mechanisms to kind of get more people interested in computer science and software. So long term, I don't really see a reason of why a developer tool, why is Visual Studio more complicated than Excel? It shouldn't. It shouldn't be. Same for, again, I don't want to single out Visual Studio and get beat up when I go back to building 42, but you know, same for our database administration, our Exchange administration tools. There's really no reason. If you actually look at the feature specs of what get done for enterprise products versus the broader consumer and enterprise products, I don't know that Exchange is more complicated than Excel or Word or Access.
So I'll assume that some of the people in our audience, either here in our live audience or in our audience out there on the internet someplace, are in a position to be developing applications that could benefit from a UI boost. Yep. What would you say to them to help them understand what they need to do in order to improve the user experience of their applications?
Well, there's kind of a mindset answer, a process answer, and technology answer. The easiest one is a technology answer. the new technologies we have, I would say, probably again, I mentioned them earlier, things like WPF, Silverlight, and Blend are super, super important for people to start looking deeper into. They change the way you think about user experience, and they change the middle part, which is the process part. We now have a very different workflow in mind about, we used to think that the role of the user designer and the art team is really kind of one of two dimensions. They'll prototype or they'll build some core assets, bitmaps. That's all, you know, bitmaps, background images. And then a lot of the work for actually programming the layout and controlling the layout and the user experience as you resize and maximize and minimize and change themes and all that stuff was developer. Well, that task just moved. Or at least we're working hard to move that task and change a part of that workflow to say, that's no longer a developer. That we really don't want the developers doing layout. We really don't want the developers doing code that handles UI, you know, screen real estate changes or theme changes or accessibility changes or all these things. We've created a new set of technologies and products specifically targeting that. So that new workflow, I think, is very interesting because it's going to kind of maybe address the first one, which is, do we have the razor sharp focus on user experience? And again, as I mentioned, it varies. And my advice to people is really, don't underestimate it. It's easily one of the most difficult things you have to work on, regardless of the product. Much harder than any algorithm, much harder than the nastiest bugs you're probably gonna run into. And take advantage of some of these new technologies. And then when you bring the artists and the creative program managers and user experience specialists into the process in a different role, where they're no longer involved early. Again, the old model was they do sketches, you code them, they do usability, you fail usability probably, they yell at you, you fix things, you know, and you iterate in that. Well, if they were in every check-in, if they're in every, they're in every day, they are sitting there building the thing with you every day, I think the products will be different at the end. And so it's
That's going to take an awful lot of work, though, for people to change the way they develop applications.
Yeah, and if you look at Visual Studio, a lot of what we've started to do internally is not, again, you know, one advice I have for people is don't boil the ocean. So what we decided in Visual Studio to do is not do a full kind of revamp of Visual Studio, but start taking advantage of these technologies in almost, again, in a feature crew level and think about what parts of the application. It doesn't mean you have to make everything look different. For example, having WPF will let me do crazy alpha blending and 3D animation, all sorts of stuff. Well, I don't really need to do that in VS. I can still use even a VS look and feel, but take advantage of the technology and the process for me to put things in VS that would have taken me less time, that would probably have better first-hand user experience, and start, again, rolling user experience, you know, into the mainstream process. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose also, you know, doing too much sometimes can be a cautionary tale. I mean, you know, we always remember, like, you know, the Macintosh when it first came out, and suddenly you can now change fonts, and you have the term font ugly.
Yep.
From a design perspective, the designers need to be embodied in the whole concept of user experience and not take it too far.
That's definitely a truism. In most UI cases, less is more. Again, I'll use the example of, you know, Office. The surface area of Office actually got simpler over time, much, much simpler in 2007. Where we got rid of most menus, most dialogues, all these things, and we just kind of found the 80th percentile and kind of, you know, made it more visible. Less is always more in UI. You can't assume that, again, it's my game experience, you can't assume just because you're a good gamer you're going to build a great game. And you can't assume just because you're a fantastic user of software you're going to build great software. The best thing you could do is be a student of software and look at what actually resonates with people. Why do people love Office so much? Why has it done so well for us? Why is there so much momentum and excitement behind the iPhone, for example? You know, just why is a simple page like Google's interesting for people? All it is just, you know, it's an edit control with two buttons, you know. So I think being a student of software and looking at what people resonate with, I don't think that's the exclusive realm of program managers or UX experts. I think that's the realm of every developer and every person who has a passion for software.
But as somewhat you touched on there with Google and iPhone and other applications like that, it's not so much just the scientific understanding of what makes it software. It's almost a personality, a soul that is embodied within that application.
Yeah, actually, Steve Ballmer used to ask this question always whenever we present a product pitch or whenever a team would present to him is kind of his, a lot of what he tried to find is what you just said exactly, what's the soul of this thing? And if he couldn't understand the soul, you were actually really in trouble, because it meant you really didn't have kind of that razor sharp focus and center of gravity. We do sometimes make user experience a little too scientific, and sometimes we insist on consistency too much. And if you look at the example of the iPhone, they actually have a weird mix of gestures that in many cases are not consistent. Sometimes, you know, flicking left to right means the next page. Well, you can't do that to flick between email accounts, for example. Sometimes the gesture of slashing through an item in the list box is the delete thing. Most other things, it doesn't even show up. So they didn't make consistency the high order bit. They made having a soul and having kind of that visceral experience associated with the user experience the high order bit. And then, you know, obviously you want to strive for consistency. It's not that, you know, that's a bad thing.
So a consistent experience, mm-hmm. even if individual parts of that maybe aren't quite so consistent.
Yeah.
And so just like, you know, individuals in the audience and stuff like that, they're not necessarily going to be acting consistently all the time, but yeah. they have a personality Absolutely. That we can recognize.
Absolutely. And again, we have that in many of our products. Actually, I would say Office is, for me, the hallmark of that phenomena, where even over time, I mean, Bill always, you know, used to complain, probably still complains about, every now and then you find a lot of inconsistencies, you know, but that's not as important as having character and having a soul and innovating, which sometimes flies in the face of consistency. To put a plug for OneNote, my favorite feature in OneNote is how you can add tables by you type in text and you start tabbing and it starts adding columns, and then Control Enter adds rows, etc. I'm giving people a OneNote tutorial here. But that's a feature I want in Word. Well, so Word doesn't have it yet.
What exactly is OneNote?
Yeah. So OneNote is the, I don't know if the word is one of the least discovered parts of Office is probably a fair term. And it was one of the apps I used to always uninstall until some team at Microsoft actually showed me how to use it. And I have to give the Office team credit. I'm hooked. And I find myself using it mostly because they found common typing cases. We all want to be able to put in some things here on the screen. What's the word I'm looking for? Spatial layout mm-hmm. of text content. That's something that's really hard to do in Word, Excel, and most of our existing tools. And I tend to do that. I tend to say, well, I'll put the important things here. I'll put the less important things, you know. Well, it does that. And then you start discovering all these other very clever features, like how easy it is to do tables in OneNote. And then you go back and say, well, why can't Word do this? But they still did the right thing. It's kind of, again, our version of the iPhone phenomenon. We found a great way to do tables in OneNote. We didn't hold up the entire world to make sure that OneNote tables and Excel tables and, you know, Word tables and all these things are, and PowerPoint tables, well, Excel is all tables, all behave exactly the same way. So that for me is a good example of, personally, I think it's okay. And I think it's also okay for Bill to beat them up and insist that they get to be more consistent over time. Mm-hmm. But the high order bit really is the actual experience.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all kind of a balancing act between form and function. And,
yep.
you know, you don't want too much form and you don't want too much function. You want to be able to use them.
Yep. And again, the unique attribute of Microsoft, probably one of the uniquest ones, is we offer people a surprising amount of function. Now, sometimes it comes at the expense of a ton of form. And every now and then we tend to find good abstractions where it's a little bit of form. And then just, you know, the amount of uses people... I mean, I've seen accounting systems built in Excel, and they look amazing. I mean, people have built, you know... They don't figuratively run their business on Excel. They really, really run their business on Excel, and it works for those scenarios.
You know, in the same way that OneNote is a piece of the Office tool set that you really kind of appreciate what they're doing UI-wise... What you're doing with Visual Studio is also kind of a small little teeny piece of the larger aspect of Visual Studio. Are you trying to kind of do the same thing there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good way to describe it. And we're not the only ones. Again, I think there's a number of teams within Visual Studio that are looking at the developer problem kind of back with first principles. Mm-hmm. Why did I have to type in that code? Why could there be a visual experience associated with this? Would it be faster? Am I better off just getting the user in the editor at this point? And... what are the things that, you know, we can end up with where a picture is worth 1,000 words? And, you know, and I think there's a number of teams, and I'm definitely hoping to be one of the teams that help kind of push us in that direction.
You've actually got an interesting work style relationship with your group.
Okay.
Being over in Hawaii mm-hmm. with such a small team like that. So I'd like to spend some time discussing that.
Okay.
To kind of introduce that, we've got a little clip from one of the people that work for you,
okay.
Alan Denver, sharing some of his concepts about what it's like to work in Hawaii.
Alan's a good guy.
We RAS in every day, and when RAS performance is bad, then, you know, we get hosed up a little bit. But by and large, it's been okay. And, you know, every once in a while we get this, you know, I need some help from somebody, and they'll just say, well, just drop by my office, you know, come by any time. And a little hard to do from Hawaii. So we're working through some of those kinds of issues.
Boy, hard to do over there in Hawaii. That's gonna be rough, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've seen the view you have outside your window, and that's a nice view of Hawaii out there.
It's hard not to have a good view in Hawaii. I mean, if you have a window, you have a good view in Hawaii. So that's the first rule. We were fortunate that the way things lined up for us, we ended up in a fairly nice building with a great view. But it's really hard not to have a nice view in Hawaii. You can't. You know, we have challenges. We're a small team. We're small. We're remote. We're part of a real product that has to really ship, that has real quality gates, real processes, real metrics that they have to kind of comply to. And it's very, very hard not to participate in the machine. It's very hard not to walk the hallways, not to talk to people. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of volunteers to come visit. Every time an issue comes up, we get a ton of you. I'll come down.
Got a meeting in the Hawaii office.
Yeah. Yeah,
I can't find a conference room here on campus. I'll book one over in the Hawaii office.
Yeah. So we get plenty of that, but it does mean we have to, actually that's kind of what I tell the team, you're almost at a disadvantage when you're that remote, because you almost have to work extra hard to prove that you really are working as hard as everyone else, because they don't see you, they don't, you know, interact with you, and all they see is nice pictures of the views in Hawaii, like, these guys are out surfing somewhere, and they're not really working, so we tend to over-promote our check-in notices because of that.
Well, I know.
I'd post them on MSW if I got a chance to.
On the team I've worked on, I've had a number of people that have been working remotely. They'd have their week that they'd work from home, or they would be working in some other calendar or something like that. And to be honest, it doesn't work all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some people that really have it down pat, and you know they're doing a good job regardless whether in the office, down the hall from you or not. And other people are, you know, it just doesn't quite have that same work ethic. Yeah.
You have to find the people who are going to be self-motivated, but disciplined enough not to deviate off the course. And that's, I haven't really thought about statistically what percentage of engineers are that way. I would say that's probably a minority in general. So it makes it challenging to recruit. Now, the counterbalance and a model that does work for a company like Microsoft is if you can find senior talent and management capacity close to these development centers, I think that addresses a lot of these issues. Having a model where you have a team of, say, 1,000 people in Redmond and then hundreds of people around the world all being managed and reporting directly into Redmond may not be the right model versus kind of a hub-and-spoke type structure where there's some local autonomy and local authority.
It's like in Hawaii, with you, you're the local authority there in Hawaii.
I would like to think so. Maybe my team, I'm not sure if they agree or not, but I'm part of it, yeah.
Now, as companies grow, Microsoft originally, when we just had, the six buildings back there and the trees and stuff like that, it was very easy to centralize everything together. As the company's grown, the expansion and movement of our people off campus was not only just inevitable, but it was required just because we don't have enough room here on campus.
Yep.
And so moving to places like Hawaii, to Los Angeles, to Florida, to Washington, D.C., and stuff like that, in Beijing. What can Microsoft do better to manage that infrastructure, or any company, so that their remote groups actually work well together?
I think the biggest challenge you really have is making sure that the remote teams have a juicy enough of a charter. And that's probably a consistent feedback you're going to get from most remote development centers in most large companies around the world. Redmond is kind of the center of power within Microsoft. A lot of all the decisions almost are made in Redmond. And federating that out in kind of a well-thought-through way is super important. We are slowly learning how to do that. But I would say, in my mind, it's probably the most important thing. Because if the model is the decisions are really happening in Redmond, and then they have to filter all the way out, and then you have to... I don't think you're going to have anywhere... A big part of the reason you want these remote distributed teams is to have the agility and the speed and the ability to react and all these things.
And we do have the tools.
Yeah.
We have SharePoint. We have Live Meeting.
Yeah.
We have Communicator.
Yeah.
We have some of the tools like that that are made to shorten the distance between people.
Yep.
Now, do you think maybe those tools aren't quite sophisticated enough to handle our problem, or we're just not using them properly?
I think we're not using them properly. Maybe we're just too old. Maybe we're just a generation that really spent a lot of time. Again, when you start in a company, and I don't know, whatever, maybe it was less than 5,000 employees when I started, and you end up with, you know, 70 or 80,000, it's hard to, you know, I think some of us, myself included every now and then, just have had a hard time kind of changing the way we work and changing the way we communicate. We're very, very quick. You know, I have to resist the urge to send email because we just, you know, it's just, we've gotten so used to this whole idea of just when in doubt, send an email or forward an email and then start this big. In exchange, I actually, one of the things you learn when you have a job like, you know, vice president in exchange, it was a great growth opportunity for me, is just be very, very, very careful what you ask people to do, because what I thought was like a simple, random little, you know, idea, not even like, let's go do this, could end up being this, you know, hundreds of people years worth of effort. So I deal with that a little less now, but, you know, again, some of that comes, I guess, with the title, where people will overinvest in maybe something that you hadn't really thought through carefully. Mm-hmm. But there are cultural things that I think we have to keep looking back at and say, are we really using the tools the right way? I think the tools are fine. There's plenty of tools. If anything, we, you know. Project management, I think we can improve the tools on that. We are. I mean, you know, Brian Harry and the team that's doing the Team Foundation server and the rest of the Visual Studio Team System folks are definitely working hard on that.
Mm-hmm. And what role do you think work-life balance flows into this whole aspect of working locally and remotely and so forth?
Oh, I'm probably the wrong person to ask about work-life balance. Mine has gotten a lot better, and it's not Hawaii. Actually, some of it is just being managed well. One day, if you do a Behind the Code with David Vaskovich, you should probably ask him about him forcing me to take my first vacation ever in 1996. But some of that, I think, self-corrects. You grow older, you have kids, your priorities slowly kind of shift, and that's totally understandable and reasonable to think that you have to have work-life balance. I know that I didn't serve myself well, probably 94 and 95 and maybe 96. I was probably averaging well over 80 hours a week for years. You do that, and to this day, I probably pay the price for that. So, you know, I know it's trite and simple. Just run the marathon, you know, and enjoy the fact. I think one of the things that we are better at as a company, we used to always be in panic. Oh, my God, if we don't do this and it doesn't ship in March, the world is going to end. Well, you miss March, the world doesn't end. You ship in May, and it was fine. You didn't have to kill yourself to get to March. And I think we've gotten more mature as a company about dates and schedule and flexibility and understanding. And we've also, because of our size and because of our success, we do have kind of the freedom to take our time a little more. And that's a very fortunate position to be in. I've done the startup thing, and that's much harder, where it actually is really true. You don't ship in May, you're out of money. Yeah, you're done. So yeah, yeah. I think, you know, especially for large companies, not just Microsoft, I think it's definitely easier to achieve that work-life balance. I do it, and I can't say that I do work hard. I like working hard. But once I get back from this 3-week trip, I'm probably going to take a couple of days off and just relax a little bit.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you're doing a great job, and I can't wait to see the product you guys are adding to Visual Studio and see the results of all the work you've done. How soon do you think we'll be able to see that?
Well, I hope to be able to talk about it. Where are we now? We're October? No, September. I hope to be able to talk about it this year. I know we'll be able to probably talk about it and show what we've been working on this year. There's a number of, kind of, again, to put the plug in for Visual Studio, there's a bunch of really exciting things that we're doing, both for Orcus, which is a release that we're, mm-hmm. you know, is in beta right now, and the next release, codenamed Rosario, that are all really, really cool. Actually, I spent a good chunk of my flight yesterday looking at click-throughs of screenshots of all the things we want to accomplish in the next VS, and I was skeptical, but now I'm happy.
That's good.
I was surprised to see these things. So hopefully you'll hear about our stuff as part of the Rosario wave, and that means really towards later part of this year, starting to hear more about it.
That's good. Well, I mean, I enjoyed talking with you. I think we're going to switch over to kind of Q&A model here, but before we do that, we have one final clip from Pat Helland, where he kind of shares with us a little more thoughts about who Mohsin is. Let's hear from Pat.
One of the most amazing things about Mohsin is that he's always making sure that the ends are not used to justify the means, only taking steps that he thinks are right and correct based upon the individual step. Because of that, people trust him, and that trust opens up the ability to forge solutions and bridge gaps and connect people where they never could before.
I think Pat put that quite well.
I paid him for it, but yeah.
I mean,
again, if you enjoy software, I think you, again, putting things in perspective is always super important. I think it actually addresses a lot of these issues. People get really, really frustrated by, you know, people are not listening to me, people are not doing it my way. And a combination of, if you have a passion for software and if you're in a place like Microsoft, which is, again, more plugs, but a great company, really takes good care of its people, has a lot of opportunity, helps you maybe relax a little more and not worry as much. The goal definitely does not justify the means. And just if you can just relax and, you know, do the best that you can to make sure that you do things the right way. And if it doesn't work out the way you thought it should work out, again, it doesn't mean it's a bad company. You know, sometimes it means you made a bad choice, and sometimes it means a good company made a bad choice, but it's still a good company. Mm-hmm. You just kind of approach it that way.
Now, I'm sure our audience has a lot of questions that they want to ask Mohsin. Mohsin, before we get to their questions, I've got a couple of questions that we always ask our guests on this show, and let's see how you do on those answers.
Two or more?
Several, okay. I think. So one of the questions we think is very important to understand is what advice you would give to other people in your field?
Don't do software. I'm just kidding. No. probably the biggest, at least the part that's really worked well for me, I've already mentioned both of them, really. Be a student of software. You know, respect and admire the work that other people have done, and look carefully at how software works. Think hard about why is it that you like this thing? Why do you like Office? Why do you like your iPhone? And not just the user experience part of it, but being a student of software and respecting the people, you know, that have gone before you is super, super important. I remember we used to use Spy to look at Office every release to see, were they really using Windows controls or these fake controls? I mean, just, you know, kind of almost that level of obsessing about what other people have done is incredibly important, mostly because we're a mature business. It's no longer kind of a very green field with just... So I would say that's probably the biggest one. Enjoy the ride. And, you know, it's nothing is as important. Nothing will be as important 10 years down the road as you thought it was this year. So relax, enjoy the ride. You know, it's a great endeavor. And it'd be too bad for you to be stressed throughout pretty much your career in doing it. So those would be the two biggest advice I'd give.
Now, the next question is one that I deal with all the time. And I frankly don't have a good answer for it. Yeah. Maybe you've got a better one than I do. But if you're needing to describe what you do to someone that's not technical, what do you say?
In the particular area I'm working on right now, maybe it's even a little... Well, no, it's not. It's never easy with software. I'll take a run at it. You can tell me if I do a good job or not. But the best way I can describe it is I'm in the business of helping people understand what software looks like on the inside. So we all know, kind of, we've all seen schematics of what cars or electronics or architectural drawings or all these things of other things. We haven't gotten used to the idea of a popular, common way for us to look at software in a consistent way. So assuming you know what software is, the area I'm focusing on is how do you look at it, kind of at that, what's a blueprint for software? What's an architectural schematic for software look like? That's the best that I can do. If you don't know what software is, then God help me. I don't think I have a good answer.
And in life, what would you compare the process of making software to?
Herding cats. I've always said movies and software are very similar, and people underestimate how much filmmaking and software have in common. And strangely enough, these two industries don't interact much. The game industry is kind of the bridge between them, but movie making is a very similar endeavor. It has the same balance of the creative aspects, the intangibles, as well as kind of the professionalism, the discipline, the studio system, the business, the processes that make it what it is. And it's, again, I think it's the two businesses are more similar than almost anything else. So being in software, it's kind of like being in the movies. Apparently, it really is a lot like being in the movies. You get interviewed at some point. But kind of that balance between creative and technical is very similar.
Yep. Except you don't officially have your names listed in the credit that scrolls by in the application.
We used to.
Yeah.
We used to, and thanks to Jim Olchin, if you're out there, Jim, watching. Yeah, but, we no longer do, and it's a good move. Because, first of all, the list would be too long these days. But yeah.
And the next one is, finish this sentence.
Okay.
You know you're a computer nerd when...
Oh, geez. Okay. You know you're a computer nerd when... You have a firstborn, you call him Pascal, and you have a secondborn, and you call her Ada. How's that? No, or, and I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not. I didn't.
Have you worried there for a second?
I thought about it, but I wouldn't even bring this up with my wife. I don't think Ada would have been an option. Yeah. I don't know what computer nerd. You know you're a nerd if you know the type of animal that the sand people ride on Tatooine in Star Wars. Does anybody know? See, I'm the biggest nerd in the room. Bantha? There you go. A couple of nerds.
Isn't that more of a Star Wars nerd than a computer nerd? Yeah.
Well, you know
what?
The two overlap more than you think. Yeah.
Now, the last thing I want to ask you before we go into the audience is we always take and ask our guests to take and draw their favorite data structure. And so I have here a nice big piece of white paper and a nice big black fat pen.
And I assume landscape.
Any order needs to be done, right?
So what I'm going to do is actually, again...
We'll show it to the audience.
It'll tell you that I'm a coder, but... And we can ask people where this is from. Very simple. Oh, I should sign?
Yes, unsign it, please.
My daughter comments that I have the easiest signature in the world to forge. She does often, so...
So here's the... So can you explain that to the audience?
Well, if I have to explain it, we have the wrong audience. But yeah. Well, can I ask how many people have seen this line?
Can you read that? Read the line.
So it says while, you know, content of destination plus plus equal content source plus plus semicolon. So who hasn't seen this line? Yeah. That's from KNR. That's the string copy code in KNR, the C programming language book, and it is full of bugs. And the standard Microsoft interview question at some point, a living Microsoft interview question, is finding all the bugs in this and figuring out whether people can understand it or not. And I was definitely asked that question in my interview in, I guess, late 89 or early 1990. And it was the wrong question to ask me because I obsess about things like that. So I had the 17 different ways you could write this and all the preconditions and past conditions, whether they overlap or upside down, all that stuff. And but it's not a data structure, so I'm cheating a little bit, but it's a C expression, and I have a soft spot
So on the face of it, I see two things wrong. There's one is the fact you get these buffer overruns with this thing, plus it's so unreadable. Yeah. Once you're not writing it, the next guy has to write it. He's not going to know what's going on.
It's also nasty I don't know if we've even fixed this so far, sitting in the debugger, because you're running multiple expressions all in one line. So it's very, I can have a whole interview on what's wrong with that line. But
So it's not your favorite data structure, it's almost your least favorite data structure.
Well, I have a soft spot for it. So I shouldn't say that I've never written code like that, but...
But you've wanted to.
I wanted, you know, there's a certain elegance about that line. I remember reading it the first time. I don't even remember how old I was. And it took me a while to figure out, what the heck, what is this? And once I figured out, I was like, oh, that's really cool. And you have to also understand all the operator precedences where a good deal of, you have three operators and a logical expression all fighting with each other in one line. So that's my favorite. And I've always, anybody asks me that, I always do that, so.
Yeah, I remember debugging into some of the Apple II ROMs once and seeing some machine code that actually looped back inside of itself in the middle of an expression in the machine code that actually did something useful. I'm going, wait, that's kind of interesting. It's
self-modifying
kind of
code.
Wish I did that, you know?
Yeah, self-modifying code is a gem that I've never really mastered fully. Yeah.
Well, so now that we've got our bulk questions out of the way,
good.
I think it's time to open them for the audience to ask the really tough questions.
Oh, okay.
So does anybody in the audience have a question they want to ask Mohsin? Okay, we got a question up here in the front.
Right now, we have a lot of developer tools that get smarter and smarter. So do you think in the near future, are we going to have the tool that require no single line of code to develop application?
Oh, that's a great question. I do get asked that question all the time. There's a buzz, I don't know if it's internal or external or both, this whole codeless development, I think, is the way people describe it. And are we going to get to a point where we're not writing code? First of all, the first answer I always give people is we did that in 1991. There's a lot of VB scenarios that really required no code. If you just wanted the form, capture some data, especially once, actually VB2, once we had data binding and the data bound controls and data source control, you could pretty much write a very simple database app without a line of code. I think there's a lot more of things like that that we can do, that we will do, in terms of, for some scenarios, for some domains, you really shouldn't be writing code. And does that mean that code is gone? No way. I mean, you know, that I'm very skeptical. Will we keep evolving languages and abstractions? Absolutely we will. I've gotten to be kind of a fan of the pattern work, for example, that, you know, design pattern work. So can we start leveraging something like that more, raise the level of abstraction? Sure, we can. Frameworks more? Sure, we can. But I do think that, you know, code, love it or hate it, will be with us for quite a while. It doesn't mean we stop having developers, by the way. Even as we have less and less code, look at where we've been. You know, you can argue we're just, you know, we'll just find new stuff to invent and more stuff to do around the new, more maybe more visual paradigms. But and we're always going to have Turing logic. Maybe somebody will look at this tape, you know, 100 years from now and just laugh their butts off. It's like, oh my God, these guys thought they're going to have Turing or imperative logic in the future. But I personally, I think that it'll be around for quite a while.
Thank you.
I mean, if you think about it, it's all about the evolution of what code is. I mean, if you go back, you know, 30 years, code was totally different than code is today. Yeah. You had, you know, wire wrapping could almost be thought of coding back
absolutely.
Then.
Absolutely. Microprogram control on the processor is coding. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's that abstraction, it's a never-ending game. It doesn't mean that things somehow miraculously get so much less complex and get so much cleaner that you don't need developers. Strangely enough, again, I think it's a virtuous cycle. The abstractions get higher. Developers get more productive. They invent even more stuff. They build bigger things. The whole thing gets more complicated than the thing before it. Then that drives an evolution to the next level of abstraction, and you rinse and repeat. So it just kind of, that cycle, I don't see it ever ending, really. Mm-hmm. It just, you give me something that makes me 10 times more productive, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build something 10 times bigger. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes complicated, and then then somebody comes back and says, I'll make that 10 times more productive.
Well, thanks, Mohsen, from the Technical Community Network, for being our guest today. And thank you in the audience for coming.